All right, so we're going to go right into Q&A, and who'd like to ask the first question? Yes, sir.
I know there's been extensive search for Noah's Ark in Mount Ararat in Turkey, but some people have realized that that's the wrong place, that they believe it may be in Iran.
Yeah. So the question is about people that have been hunting for Noah's Ark, looking, you know, to see if maybe Noah's Ark is still, its remains still exist someplace, and we could find it as kind of an archaeological artifact that would help us, you know, confirm the Bible's teachings about history. And you mentioned that. Some people believe it's on what's called Mount Ararat in Turkey, and others believe it's not on that mountain, it's elsewhere. So what the Bible says is that the ark landed in the mountains, plural, of Ararat. And we know generally kind of where that is, but it's kind of a long, you know, mountain range, so there's lots of speculation as to where the actual place of the ark was. You can also take into account other factors about the biblical description, about the people, where they migrated after the flood, between the flood and the Tower of Babel and so forth. And so some people do believe that the ark is on what's today known as Mount Ararat. And that designation, I believe, came much later in history. So it's just kind of the traditional Mount Ararat, but we don't know if that's really the landing site of Noah's Ark. But there have been some reports in historical times about people claiming to have seen it. I personally tend to regard a lot of those sightings with some suspicion. We at Creation Ministries International would love to find the ark or be aware of somebody who has found it and report on that. But so far, we've not been convinced by any of the investigations that have been done. By and large, they come up with very kind of flimsy evidence. There have been some claims about other locations where people have said that they have found the ark. Like there was a kind of an amateur archaeologist named Ron Wyatt who found, he had a location down in a valley. I think that was also in Turkey. But it turns out what he claimed was Noah's Ark is just a natural geological formation. And so we've got some articles on our website debunking his claims in detail. There was also a claimed discovery of Noah's Ark a few years ago by a Korean team that went up on Mount Ararat. Now, a lot of Ararat is covered in ice and snow. So a lot of people believe it's buried in the ice and snow. That's why it's so hard to find. You can't just, like, look with binoculars up on the mountaintop or satellite imagery, right? So if it is there, it's hard to detect. But there was a claim that this Korean team had found the ark. It turns out that was basically a hoax, and we exposed that on our website as well. So, again, even though we would love to see the real ark discovered, we want to be careful about using the best evidence that's available and not jumping on the bandwagon of something that later turns out to be a hoax or something that's just not a very credible source and those sorts of things. So I'm open to either possibility about where the ark might have landed. I would probably lean away from the traditional Mount Ararat and say that it was on some different location that might not even exist any longer in the world today. For instance, a lot of creationist geologists have argued that whole region where the traditional Mount Ararat is located, those mountains were kept changing and tectonic forces moved those mountains, and there was also volcanic activity post-flood that would have totally dramatically changed that region of the world. And so if Noah's Ark had been there, it would be buried underneath, you know, mounds and mounds of volcanic lava and so forth. So the Ark might not be anywhere to be discovered. And my suspicion is that we're not going to find the Ark, that it might have been, since Noah and his family, there were only 8 people that survived the flood, they likely would have, you know, there's nowhere else to find, you know, civilization that you can borrow from their technology. They probably would have disassembled the ark and used it for temporary shelters or other purposes after the flood. That's speculation, so I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. But there are some other articles on our website as well about some different ark locations. Not people that have claimed to have found it, but just saying, based on the biblical clues, where would the ark have landed? And some of those articles have suggested it points away from from Mount Ararat to other regions. But anyway, I guess that's all for that one. Next question. Yes, sir.
Do you have any discussions in your resources about the evidence in physics that claims to contradict time scales with regard to the speed of light and the travel distances and such?
Yes, okay, so the question is about do we have information about how challenges from physics to the biblical worldview, and especially the biblical timeline in particular, and how it's claimed that the stars are really far away, and it would take light time to travel to Earth, much more time than, you know, I said that the universe is somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 years old, but if the stars are really far away, and light doesn't travel instantaneously, it travels, 186,000 miles per second or something, and so in a year's time, light will travel a distance of one light year. Right? You've heard the term light year before. That's a distance, not a measurement of time. So if light travels one light year in a year, and let's say there's a star 6,000 light years away, then in order for us to be seeing that light hitting our eyeballs right now, looking out in the night sky, looking at that star, the light must have left it 6,000 light years ago and traveled for 6,000 years until now, just now, today, it's finally hitting our eyeballs, okay? Does that make sense? That's the conventional interpretation of starlight and time and travel. And so the problem for us as creationists is, well, there are supposed to be stars way further out than 6,000 light years, billions of light years away, okay? And so doesn't that prove that the stars are billions of years old, disproving what Jesus said about Adam and Eve here from the beginning of creation and creation in six literal days and so forth. Now, as a young man, I thought about that question. I'd heard it raised, and I thought, well, that's easy because it says in Genesis that God said, let there be light. And that was before he made the sun, moon, and stars, right? God said, let there be light on day one. Not until day four did God make the sun, moon, and stars. So maybe God created the beam of light on its way. And that would fit with other things we believe about supernatural creation, because, for example, I believe that God created Adam and Eve as mature adults. He didn't create them with an appearance of age, meaning Adam would have been old and wrinkly. He wouldn't have had memories in his brain of things that occurred that never really did, right? He wouldn't have been created with a deceptive appearance of age, but Adam would have been created mature as a full-grown adult, not an embryo, right? Or a tiny baby or something that had to grow up still. So I think there's an important distinction there. God creates with maturity, but he doesn't do things that are deceptive. So now the difficulty with starlight and time is that the difficulty with my view as a child that maybe God just created the light beam on its way all the way to Earth, and that's how we can see the distant stars, is that that seems to make God deceptive in a certain way. And why would I say that? Well, because we don't just see fixed points of light streaming into us from our telescopes. What we see is events happening out in space, billions of light years away, like stars exploding. And so if you say that God created this beam of light on its way to Earth, including an image of a star exploding, now that hits our eyeballs today, and we say, okay, that means God created 6,000 light years away from me an image of an exploded star. But supposedly where that star is located is way further out beyond that. So the light never had time to travel all the way from that star to my eye, and the star never even existed, right? Because to be consistent, God would have to create like debris way out there in the universe, and 6,000 years ago, the image of the exploded star, and then it traveled to me, and now I finally see it today. So you see the problem? It suggests that God created little pictures of things happening in the sky that never really happened. Okay, so that's the dilemma. So this is one of the hardest questions for creationists, a big part of the reason many people do not hold to our point of view. But I want to explain how this is not a completely impossible problem to overcome. And in fact, for those who say that's too difficult for creationists to answer, so I'm going to believe instead in the traditional cosmology, I'm going to believe in the Big Bang, for example, they actually have the same problem that we do. Because in their story, there are things that you see out in space that can't have happened without, there's no way from light to get from one point to another side in the universe in order to make their story plausible. Because what they believe is, if you're familiar with this, this will be a little bit technical here, but I'll try to not go into too much depth. And you can read more about this, by the way, in the Creation Answers book. We have a whole chapter on this. It's called the Distant Starlight Problem or something like that, a chapter on distant starlight. So what the Big Bang people believe is that what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, I know that's a mouthful, that's one of the evidences for the Big Bang. It basically just means every direction we look out in space, we see microwaves, microwave radiation coming in at us. It's not dangerous to you, but it's like the microwaves in your microwave oven. And it's low intensity. So it turns out that no matter where you look, the temperature of that radiation is very even, extremely evened out. And they believe the only way for that to happen is for the light to interact. Okay, so the light can exchange energy from one side of the universe to the other. Kind of like if you have a hot cup of coffee, it can't come to the same temperature as its surroundings without being in contact with them. You got to put an ice cube in the coffee in order for the ice cube and the coffee to come to the same temperature, all right? If they're separated by millions of, you know, miles apart, they're not going to come to the same temperature. So the evolutionists have to come up with very speculative theories about how to get light to travel from one part of the universe to the other in order to get the light all evened out, the same temperature everywhere. So it's the same problem that they have with getting light from one point to another in less time than seems available. So now, what do creationists say about the potential solutions to this problem? They've come up with creationist physicists, astrophysicists, cosmologists have come with a whole variety of solutions to this problem. Some of those include ideas that Einstein talked about, how time actually flows at different rates in different parts of the universe. Now, that might if you've never heard about that before, that might sound really bizarre, but that's standard physics. So the secular community accepts that. Creationists, informed creationists, would accept that as well. Our ministry certainly does. That time can actually, gravity, for example, can actually distort time itself, how fast physical processes flow. So that in one part of the universe, clocks can run very slowly, and in a different part of the universe, they can run very quickly. And so I won't go into any more details here. That's probably way too much information for all of you. But if you want to check out the details about creationist solutions to distant starlight, read through that chapter in the Creation Answers book. All right. Yes, sir.
Do you guys have any materials on quantum mechanics and quantum physics theories?
Yeah, we've got a good article. We've probably got several, but I'm thinking of one in particular that just talks about quantum mechanics in general and what should be the creationist perspective on it. Because there are some creationists who want to challenge conventional physics and that kind of thing, including quantum mechanics. All the leaders in our ministry, the scientists that we employ, as well as many of our friends, do affirm quantum mechanics. We think it's the interpretations of it, that certain interpretations of it go against Scripture, but the basic mathematical and scientific, underpinnings of the theory are consistent with biblical claims. So I just point you to the website to see more about that. All right, another one in the back.
James has used the term time.
Yes.
Does that term have an equivalent in modern scientific terminology
Yes, very good question. So if you didn't hear, the question is, in Genesis, it says God created the different forms of life according to their kinds. And what is a kind exactly? How does that correspond with the modern scientific classification system that labels things kingdom, phylum, class, however that goes. Kingdom, phylum, genus is way down there. Anyway, family, order, genus, species, something like that. Creationists have actually done a lot of research to try to determine what the boundaries of the kinds are. Because, yeah, we believe that God created basic types, basic kinds, which is a non-technical term, right? But we would say, originally, those kinds were the ones that were able to interbreed among themselves, but one kind can't mate with another kind and produce offspring, okay? Now, our modern definition of species, a lot of people think that creationists should believe that one species can never transform into multiple species, but actually that's not what we believe. We believe there can be many species within each biblical kind. And why would I say that? Well, let me give you an example. So tigers and lions and leopards are different species. But do you think it's possible that they're all related?
Yeah.
They go back to a common ancestor that was also a big cat, right? And so God built into these different kinds a lot of potential for variety. Just like all the people in this room look a little bit different from one another, right? We've got different hair colors, eye colors, skin shades, and so forth. But we all go back to just two people, Adam and Eve, because there's a lot of potential for variety in our DNA. So with the cat kind, for example, one of the ways we know that lions and tigers, even though they're different species, we should classify them as the same biblical kind, is that you can breed them. Now, they don't normally in the wild tend to mate together, but it is possible that will happen sometimes when you put them in cages close together, sometimes without people even trying to breed them together, they'll have offspring. And that's right. When you cross a male lion and a female tiger, you get a liger. So ligers are real. So are tigons. That's if the male is the tiger. And it's not just with cats. The same thing is true. You can do hybridization experiments with other mammals, for example. You can cross a goat and a sheep to get a geep or something. You can cross a camel and a llama to get a llama, right? There was even at one of the water theme parks, they had a false killer whale in a tank with a dolphin, and they were surprised when one of them got pregnant, right? And it produced a wolfin. And it turns out that, now some people say, well, often those hybrids are sterile. They can't go on to produce more offspring. Sometimes they can. Even with mules, occasionally a mule can produce more babies. And a wolfin, for example, produced more baby wolfins. And so, but it doesn't matter whether or not they can go on to reproduce more. The fact that two animals can mate together and breed and create offspring, I think, suggests that they're the same biblical kind. So what that means is kinds are broader categories than species. What about the next level up? Genus. There's species, genus, and then family. Sometimes you can actually see even two different genera, that's the plural of genus, can mate and produce offspring. So it turns out with some, now I don't think the biblical term kind maps on precisely to that Linnaean classification system. With mammals, most of the research shows that it tends to fall about the family level. So family and below, a family would represent a biblical kind. All right, but it might not be the same thing if we're not talking about mammals, if we're talking about plants or insects. And that's because classification is somewhat arbitrary. It's just however you want to group the animals. And so, but the reason that sort of thing is important is it shows that creationists do believe in a lot of variety, a lot of biological changes. If we start with two calves on board Noah's Ark, and they gave rise probably to all the cats we have today, including lions, tigers, pumas, leopards, jaguars, down to little house cat Fluffy, all right? They're probably all related back to a common ancestor. But that's not evolution, because the kinds of changes that produce those different varieties within a kind, those changes are going downhill. They're in the wrong direction. They're not building new organisms. They're taking what's already there and separating out the potential for variety that God built in, or mutations occur and ruin some of the genetic instructions that God built them with. And so you can have, take a lot of our domestic varieties of dogs, our dog breeds, for example, most of those have all kinds of mutations, mutational defects that have enabled you to get the tiniest little, a chihuahua and a dachshund and so forth. Dogs weren't created necessarily with all that potential for variety, but some of those changes have occurred due to degenerative mutations. And losing things, breaking things, is not going to build up to evolution. So creationists believe in lots of change, but not evolutionary types of changes that could turn molecules into man over millions of years. It also helps us to explain how Noah could fit all the animals on board the ark, by the way. Because, sometimes skeptics object to Noah's flood by saying, well, there's millions and millions of species out there. How could Noah take all these millions of animals and insects and plants and so forth on the ark? Well, first of all, God told him to take the land-dwelling, air-breathing animals, including the birds, but he didn't have to take aquatic animals. He didn't necessarily have to take insects on board. Many of them might have been on board, but they weren't required to go, right? Insects could survive a flood by floating on log mats of vegetation and so forth, things like that. So Noah just took the land-dwelling, air-breathing animals on board the ark, but he had to take relatively few, maybe a few thousand animals, not millions and millions of species, because he took two cats rather than a lion, a tiger, or two of each of those, right? A male and a female lion, male and female tiger, etc. So understanding what the word kinds means helps us to understand both the change that we see in living organisms as well as how the animals could survive the flood. All right, who's next? Yes, sir.
Something you mentioned earlier, just to think through both arguments, whether you're, you know, on our side as creationists or evolutionists, that they're both presuppositional. Right? So we have a belief, and it's interesting to me, and I'd be curious from your perspective, why is it that if they're presupposition, they're trying to find a way to make evolution work, right?
Yeah.
And so they're coming up with all these different things, but nothing. Where we have consistency, we always go back to the exact same point of consistency. That stuff is like a spaghetti mess, because like you said, well, the dinosaurs go back 50 million years ago. Well, you know, we were just at Disney World and we saw a sign on the wall and held with the dinosaurs. And we were,
it was 65 plus. Yeah.
There was one that said 250 million years ago. Even their dates are so inconsistent of what's well, where and what's what. So I'd be curious, you know, what from your perspective, how do you see when we hear dinosaurs and when the kids are taught about dinosaurs or evolution? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's 3 million, sometimes it's 100 million, sometimes it's a billion. It's so random.
It's like 250 million.
Well, there that particular thing I don't think is necessarily an inconsistency, if because what they believe is they went extinct 65 billion years ago. So okay, and sorry, I have to repeat the question for those in the back. So if you didn't hear, the question was about just the consistency of evolutionist dates and the presuppositions that we bring with us to the table, both creationist and evolutionist. And so what evolutionists believe is that dinosaurs, I don't know what the oldest date is when dinosaurs first evolved, according to them, but it would have been on the order of hundreds of millions of years ago. And then they're saying they lasted for all that time. Remember, we're counting backwards through time up to the time of Christ, right? So 300 million years ago, and then getting closer to the present, you get down to 65 million years ago. That's when the dinosaurs went extinct, so there shouldn't be any more after that time. But it's permissible if they have them before that. But there are certainly problems with their dating methods and their consistencies, and a lot of times museum signs and things like that will be out of date. Like I just went last year to our museum in Atlanta for the first time, the Natural History Museum there, and they have a sign that says, none of the dinosaurs ever ate grass. And now I knew that was incorrect because I've been reading our Creation magazine, and we had an article about how they used to believe that because why? They never found grass fossilized in the same layers as dinosaurs. And that's typically, you know, they'll say if you don't find the two things fossilized together, that proves they never lived together. That's why they say man and dinosaurs were separated by millions of years. But it turns out that, you know, of course, a creationist would say, let me back up. So the evolutionists did believe that dinosaurs were plant eaters by and large. They just think there were other plants around back then, and grasses had not yet evolved until 10 million years after the last dinosaur went extinct. Right? So grass supposedly came into existence 55 million years ago. But then they discovered that that wasn't true at all because they found a very special kind of fossil. The technical name is a coprolite. And a coprolite, anybody know what it is? Fossil dung. They found some coprolites from a dinosaur that had microscopic bits of grasses inside, and that's how they now agree dinosaurs and grass did live at the same time. So they are constantly changing their story, you know, and the museum displays have not yet been updated with that more recent information. We published about how it shows that this assumption that if you don't find two things fossilized together, they didn't live at the same time, that assumption is not necessarily true. For example, whales and coelacanths. Coelacanth is supposed to have been an extinct fish. They thought it was extinct until a number of years ago they found it swimming around in the Indian Ocean, right? You might have heard of it. It looks the same as the fossils that are supposed to be millions of years old. But before they discovered it, they would have said, well, we find coelacanths in these very old layers, not with whales that evolved much more recently. So they would have said whales and coelacanths never lived together. Well, clearly they do because they're living together right now, you know. So there must be some other reason why we don't find them fossilized together. So creationists can explain the order in the fossil record, It has to do with the ordering effects of Noah's flood. Maybe the flood demolished certain ecological zones, maybe the lowlands before the higher and higher lands. Maybe creatures with more intelligence escaped to higher ground until the last minute and were less likely to be buried by the floodwaters and fossilized, etc. So we have some explanations of why there would be an order to the fossil record, but the evolutionist claims about the order are getting overturned all the time.
So we should all carry around pictures of Pachysaurus? Well, here, there's one, here's the other.
Yep. I do have a, when I do my dinosaur talk, I give this example about the coprolite, and I bring a real specimen of that on the plane with me, real fossil dinosaur dung. And sometimes I don't make it through the x-ray machines. And they have to do a chemical analysis. What is this in your suitcase, sir? Well, anyway. Okay, so, you asked about presuppositions as well. So, that's certainly an important part of this controversy. And I think when we go out into the world and do our science, we shouldn't lay aside our Christian worldview. We should bring it with us, bring our presuppositions to the table, and do our science as Bible-believing Christians. You know, that's why a lot of even Christians get tripped up and start believing in evolution, is because they think, no, I have to be neutral when I step into science, somehow leave my Christianity at the door. I think that's a completely wrong approach. That they approach science with this philosophy called methodological naturalism. That means naturalism is the idea that nature is all there is, and methodological means that's how they operate. That's the method they use when they're doing science. So it's not that they really believe that there is no God, but they think when I'm doing my science, I have to act as though there's no God. Well, that's preposterous. If God is real, then he's impacted the world, and we should expect to see evidence of that reality, of the Bible's history, of God's nature in the scientific realm. Romans 1 says that people who look at nature and deny God are without excuse, right? All right, next question. Or are we out of time here? Okay. If anybody needs to leave, Kalen is over here at the book tables, and he can help you check out. So don't feel like you're stuck here if you wanted to get up and leave. But I'll continue going with questions for a while yet if you guys want to. Yes, sir. Are there human fossils? Yes, but those tend to be in the upper layers. You know. So again, I do believe that there is an order, a general pattern that we do find in the fossil record. Now, it's possible that there are some human fossils deeper down in those layers that creationists would identify as flood rocks, right? Fossils that were buried in the flood. But since the evolutionary paradigm kind of dominates the mainstream scientific community, if they ever found a human bone in there, it would have to be a remarkably compelling example for them to accept it as such. It would overthrow everything they believe. And so it's possible that they have found some human remains or fragments of them and misidentified them. That sort of thing has happened from time to time. We've got articles on our website about that. And there have been claims about some very ancient human fossil. I mean, I don't believe the dates anyway, right? I don't believe in the millions of years. But according to their understanding of the geologic column, there have been some claims about human fossils that go back several million years. But we certainly do find plenty of bones of ancient humans, some of which look like a lot of the skeletons that, if you x-ray people in this room, they look very much like us. There are also some differences from some of the ancient humans. Like we find Neanderthal bones, for example. There are tons of specimens of Neanderthals, right? So the evolutionists think of Neanderthals as proof for evolution. But actually, although you can recognize differences between their skulls and your average modern human today, you can see some of their features in different people, throughout the world today. They have some distinct features like a thicker brow ridge here. They've got a little bit of a bun on the back of their skull. Certain things like that. But they stood upright. They seem to have used fire and stone tools and, hunted their meat with spears that they had a wooden shaft and a stone tip to it. So these were intelligent human beings. There's no question in my mind that Neanderthals were human beings. And yet, we find them all over Europe and the Middle East and so forth, and other forms as well, Homo erectus, modern Homo sapiens, and so forth. So I believe those are all genuine human beings, not only descendants of Adam and Eve, but even descendants of Noah after the flood, because you find them buried in the uppermost layers. Oftentimes, they're even buried like in a grave or something like that, you know, as opposed to just randomly, haphazardly being buried by a landslide or something like that, you know what I mean? Yes.
I do recall and read in the high school textbook of the curriculum that, you know, about radiocarbon dating and that, things of that nature. Could you explain some of the flaws to us about radiocarbon dating, such as, for a minor example, the instance of the volcanic, petrified volcanic rock that was found like for.
I'm not sure what the last example is that you're referring to, but carbon dating in general is one of the common questions we get. So it's also in the red, the Creation Answers book there, and there's a chapter that answers that question. And so this is thought to be one of the other biggest challenges. Just like I said, the distant starlight was probably the hardest question for creationists to answer. Radiometric dating in general is the other one. Now, most people have heard of carbon dating, and usually what people mean when they ask you about carbon dating is, what about all these different dating methods that supposedly prove millions of years, billions of years? Carbon dating actually doesn't go back that far. Now, if it works just like the mainstream scientific community says it does, it would give ages in the neighborhood of up to, like, say, 100,000 years maybe max, somewhere in that neighborhood, 100,000 years ago. Well, that is a lot older than I said the Bible's history permits, so it would be a problem for the Bible. But it doesn't give millions or billions of year ages. So if you hear somebody say, carbon dating proves the world is millions of years old, you know right away that they have no idea what they're talking about, all right? Carbon dating doesn't go back that far. But let me deal with both of those different forms of dating separately. Okay, so all dating methods make assumptions, all right? So a good illustration of how dating methods work would be, if you walk into a bathroom, let's say, that's where there's a bathtub filling up with water, and I ask you the question, how long did it take to fill up the tub to its current level? All right, and so let's say you measure the amount of water that's in the tub at present, and it is exactly 10 gallons of water. Okay, 10 gallons with the best scientific equipment available. Nobody questions the measurement. And that's the same thing that's true with radiometric dating methods. Nobody's questioning the scientific precision of the instruments. They're wonderful. All right, so there's 10 gallons of water in the tub, and the water, you measure how fast it's coming out of the tap, and it's 5 gallons per hour. So how long did it take to fill up the bathtub?
2 hours.
Your answer is precisely consistent with the information I gave you, but it could be precisely wrong, because you had to make a whole bunch of assumptions in order to give me that answer. That's because you can't measure age. You measure the amounts of water, the rate, and then you make inferences about the age. So what assumptions did you have to make to give me that answer? Yes, steady flow. How fast was the water coming out through the whole history? Was it always coming out at that same rate? Maybe it was, you know, pouring out really fast in the past, and then somebody cranked it back, so now it's only just dripping out a little bit at a time. How much water did the tub start with? Did it start with zero amount? That's what you all assumed, right? Maybe it didn't start with those initial conditions. Maybe there were different initial conditions. Did the water get into the tub only from the faucet? Maybe, you know, there's a leak in the roof and it came in through the ceiling. Maybe somebody used a hose and buckets of water and poured them in there. Has the water gotten out of the tub through any method that you didn't think about? Maybe somebody had the drain open for a while. Maybe there's a crack in the tub and some leaked out at some point. Maybe it evaporated away in the past, right? There's all sorts of assumptions you have to make about the past in order to come up with a date. That is true for all dating methods. So they all make some kinds of assumptions. Now, sometimes they can seem very reasonable, and they may be, but the point is that even the most precise dating methods are going to make some kind of assumptions along those lines, all right? So even the dating methods, whether there are many that point to a relatively young age of the universe. Did you know that? There are many physical processes that you can measure that say, hey, the world's not millions of years old. It's a maximum of, you know, this many thousand or something. And you can read about those evidences on our website. There's a good article, actually, 101 different evidences that point, scientific evidences that point to a young age of the Earth and solar system and universe and so forth. But even those dating methods are going to have to rely on assumptions. It's just a matter of how reliable you think they are. So the way, well, I won't go into how carbon dating works, but One of the major assumptions in carbon dating is the initial amounts. What evolutionists assume is that the amount of radioactive carbon in the atmosphere today compared to the amount of non-radioactive carbon has been the same all throughout history. If the relative amounts have changed in the atmosphere, then carbon dating, the fundamental assumptions are flawed. And we have good reason to think the Genesis flood would upset the carbon balance of the atmosphere. So I know that's a bit technical. You can read in our literature about that. But what's really interesting is that carbon dating actually argues against millions of years. It's the friend of the creationists. And how's that? Because as I said, it doesn't give dates in the neighborhood of millions of years. It gives dates much younger. So if you do date something that's supposed to be millions of years old with carbon dating, it will, and it contains, it's the type of thing you can do. Like it contains carbon, maybe a fossil or a layer of coal or natural gas or something like that. It will give you a date that's on the order of just thousands of years old. And it's supposed to be millions and millions or billions. Like creationists have done carbon dating of diamonds. They're supposed to be over a billion years old, and it turns out the carbon dates come back and say it's like in the neighborhood of 60,000 years old. That's a major problem with the evolutionary way of thinking about dating methods. And they kind of sweep those results under the rug or say, oh, it must be contamination, but they're not looking at the scientific evidence and evaluating it fairly. What they're doing is using their presuppositions to trump the evidence and saying, I know evolution is true, therefore it must be contamination and so forth. Diamonds, it's hard to argue contamination in the case of diamonds because diamonds are like the hardest substance known, and they'd be unlikely to be contaminated in that way. And it's carbon, radioactive carbon is ubiquitous throughout the geologic column. In every layer that we date, there's radioactive carbon, and there should be zero there. It should have all decayed away by now if the world is millions of years old. So carbon dating is really the friend of the young Earth creationist. That's a well-kept secret. And then the other dating methods, so it's probable that the rate of decay is the problematic assumption with those. And so we don't necessarily have a complete answer yet as to why we get certain dates the way we do. There is a bit of a mystery there. Creationists continue to investigate that question, but we certainly have enough information to know that the carbon dates contradict the longer ages. So you shouldn't just arbitrarily reject the carbon dates and say these ones are right. We have just as strong evidence on our side to say both dates can't be right because they're giving contradictory results. So either one is right and the other is wrong, or they're both wrong. And I think they're probably both wrong because they both make assumptions and contradict God's word about the timescale of Earth history.